Thank you very much for a very nice introduction to me personally, and as well as a very good introduction to our themes. I expect to pick up on at least one of those topics, and I hope a couple of them in the course of my discussion. Can everybody hear me? Let's get this. Okay, having trouble here. Fine. Is this better? Should I stay this way? Okay, I'll try not to move around too much. If I get excited and walk off, remind me and tell me to stay where I need to be. Thank you for that nice introduction. You reminded me of my nice time in Rome during the Gulf War. The Secretary of Defense was the current Vice President, and the head of the National Endowment for the Humanities was his wife. And I tell people, when they sort of look surprised that I had such a nice grant, that Dick told Lynn to get me out of the country during the war. Italians are always shocked by this, by the way. One thing, you're not supposed to joke about academic accomplishments. And secondly, they lived under the delusion that America is this society where everything is done on the basis of merit and family has no influence. And of course, Italy, everything is family, and merit occasionally has influence. I mean, you know, they didn't keep Michelangelo from painting things because he wasn't related to the right person. But the idea that there actually would be family connections in the United States and this might influence matters really sort of, I stopped saying it. They were too shocked. That they thought they had their vision of us as these all-out ruthless people always going for the individual and ignoring all other considerations. And it was spoiling it then when they discovered it isn't that way at all, really. The king in Alice in Wonderland, when asked by the rabbit how the rabbit should organize his talk, told him, begin at the beginning, go to the end, then stop. I'm not going to do that. I'm not sure where the beginning is, and certainly the beginning is before the Greeks, and it's before the Romans. The earliest great urban cultures that existed in Egypt, in Mesopotamia, were great societies based on organization to irrigate their fields and needed centralized government to organize that great effort. Their rule was heavily centralized and usually with divine authority. In Egypt, they were lucky enough to have a god himself as their ruler, which makes it a lot more convenient when you're checking on legal matters. In the case of Mesopotamia, there was divine choice and handing down of the law to the authorities. Those of you who have been to the Louvre may remember the great Hammurabi stele with sun god Shamash handing Hammurabi the laws that we're looking at. The Greeks and the Romans did things differently. Let me briefly run over what the Greeks did and also look a little bit at the Romans, because part of what the Greeks and the Romans did was an accident. There's no question about it. The Greeks came down into the Greek mainland in the early second millennium. They set up a wealthy, centralized urban culture as soon as they could. It took hundreds of years. They modeled themselves on the other societies of the ancient Near East. We have records of that society from near the time when it collapsed, about 1200 BC, and everything was counted. Everybody knew what was owned by the state and what wasn't. But that society collapsed for whatever reason. And it takes hundreds of years for things to start up again. And Greece is a mountainy land. There isn't a lot of land for farming. Its coast is craggy. There are many different harbors. And the society broke into a lot of small family farms. And the hundreds of years that separated prehistoric Greece from the classical historic period of the last millennium of the BC period was one in which the Greeks were family farmers. And in that time, they developed an attitude toward that way of life which did not accept it as an unfortunate second best, if only they could be like Egypt or Mesopotamia, but instead as a way of life that needed to be preserved. If you're going to preserve your family farm, you need the concept of private property and family property. You then need to have some rule of law that can help you preserve that property. In the great Shield of Achilles that Hephaestus creates for Achilles in the 18th book of the Iliad, we see two great cities, a city at war and a city at peace. But the city at peace is not a city without conflict. There is conflict. And that conflict is settled by two men standing up and arguing their case before a set of judges, and a reward will go to the judge who gives the best response. Consensual government, as the Greeks gradually developed it to protect the private property of their family farms, involves the need for the citizen, the inhabitant of the community, to participate, to speak in his own defense in law courts, to speak and give his point of view during the public political conflicts. It involves not only free government, but free speech. All these together formed an ideal which the Greeks and the Romans both had, which we don't find elsewhere in the Mediterranean and we don't find elsewhere in the world. The idea of freedom, the idea of consensual government, and the idea of the citizen. The Greeks had a word for these things, eleutheria, freedom, politeia, consensual rule, polites, citizen. Citizen is a farmer, soldier, citizen. He is active in preserving his own property, maybe a small business too, of course. He defends his country and owns his own arms to defend it. He takes part in both the legal and the political life of his community. It's an ideal that is very, very rare in the history of the world. It isn't a cultural universal. It isn't like myth. It isn't like the incest taboo. You don't find it in every society. It grew up at a few points in the ancient world and survives in our society as an inheritance from the ancient world. I'll wait until we get to the Romans to talk about the real issues of vocabulary here, but for a long time it seemed that society was an accident. They grew up in a backwater area, hardly larger than Rhode Island, and wouldn't be very important. The fact is, the great Egyptian and Mesopotamian empires themselves were taken up in the great Persian Empire, which united the Near East in peaceful, relative prosperity for two centuries. Anybody who knows anything contemporary history will know that producing peace in the ancient, in the Near East, either ancient or modern, is a very hard thing to do. And there is no reason for us to look down upon the Persian Empire. It was a great creation of a great people. And it did something that is very hard to do and which we have not been able to do. However, at a certain stage in its development, the Persians decided that to round out their control of the Near East, they really needed to control Greece. The result was one of the most catastrophic campaigns in the history of campaigning. There's no question about it. And why it was a catastrophe is still a question of debate, because power, organization, intelligence, and enormous, enormous numbers went against a very small group of disorganized, small communities composed of troops who had no professional training, but had the same training to be a soldier they did to be a citizen or a lawyer. They were ordinary people defending their property and their cities. And they won a spectacular victory. In fact, a spectacular series of victories. And for 200 years, that kind of society grew from a small backwater until by the end of the 4th century, 200 years after the defeat of the original Persians, the kind of society that were created by the Greeks in the 5th and early 6th and 5th and 4th centuries was able to conquer that Persian Empire. By that time, however, they had themselves fallen under the rule of a kingdom, Macedonia. And the society that replaced them was not a citizen society. It was not the great centralized empire that the Persians had given the ancient Near East. It was a set of competing empires, representing different parts of the Mediterranean, still an impressive and creative one, but indeed not the great one of the high point of Greek classical society, one which itself by this time had been subject to the criticisms we just heard outlined so well by Jim Stoner, by Plato and Aristotle. The Roman situation was also to some extent an accident. They lived in a part of Italy where there was a river flowing all year long. In Italy, that's very rare, so they could engage in trade. The soil in their part of Italy was very rich. However, it was very close to a volcanic base, which meant that if you didn't keep farming it a lot and working it, it turned into a swamp. And indeed, once the Republican period ended, that area did turn into a swamp, and a very dangerous one for really a long, long time. Late antiquity, it's already a swamp, and it isn't cleared up until the 1920s. I can't remember who was running Italy back then, but something to do with trains. I'll have to check into the modern history. I didn't check all the modern history. The only way you keep that area from becoming a swamp is you keep farming it all the time. And the result was the Romans also developed a system of small family farms for their prosperity and also for their health. Once you get moderately prosperous, you find people want to take the stuff away from you, and the hill peoples of Italy were always coming down and trying to rob the Roman farmers, who had to be ready and organized. And so the Roman state was based upon an ideal built up really through centuries of small farmers who owned their own arms and could work together to fight, to drive off the raiders, and to work together in law courts and in government to choose their own form of government. There's no question the Roman Constitution was different from that of Athens or that of Sparta, but it was essentially similar in the reality of an ideal of freedom, which they too had a word, libertas, an ideal of consensual government, which they had a word, res publica, and the ideal of the citizen, civis. And the citizen for the ancient Roman, as for the ancient Greek, was the same. A farmer, soldier, citizen. A person who owns his own property, a person who owns his own arms, a person who participates as soldier, lawyer, and speaker. This ideal is one which was well understood by the founders of the United States of America. They understood that it was an historical tradition. They understood that it arose in only a few parts of the world, and all in all, not forever, for hundreds of years at a time. They understood that it was an accomplishment, that you needed to defend that way of life, and that the way of life that's represented in its ideal by the citizen is the basis, not the particular form of government. Sparta, Athens, Rome all have different, technically, form of governments. And the Constitution set up by the founders is different from any of them. But premised on the idea that the way of life of a fulfilled citizen in his community is the highest ideal, and that is to be defended. The form of government is not the ideal, it's the way of life. The form of economic organization is not the point, it's the way of life. Let me mention briefly the business of vocabulary again, because it's commonly acted as though it doesn't matter whether people have good vocabularies, whether we defend our speech. But in fact, that's not true. Perhaps the most important inheritance of the ancient to the modern world is precisely the words they gave us. You can look all over the world for societies to find a word freedom. What you'll find is where it exists, it comes from the Greeks and Romans. It isn't a natural growth. You can look all over the world for a word that means citizen. It's just like looking for the origins of science. There's an historical point in the past in which these things were developed, lived, and thought about. They exist in our society as an inheritance from that period, not as a new creation, and there is no reason to think they could be created from scratch again. I've actually left out part of the equation in talking about freedom, consensual government, and citizen, because there's a negative side too that's essential to get, and which the Greeks developed and which the Romans worked on as well, which was well known to the founders. That's the idea of the bad side. I'm going to talk about empire in just a moment here, but before I talk about empire, I want to talk about tyrant. The ideal situation in which freedom is represented in consensual government run by citizens has another side to it, the idea of the tyrant. Actually, the earliest Greek tyrants were part of the development toward consensual government. There was an economic crisis in the 7th century. The Lydians invented money. Let's not get into all the problems that having money creates. And in the face of that, the Greek cities often turned toward a figure who was not a traditional figure. But they did so and ruled them as A tyrant was only one of the names, by the way. There were a whole bunch of different names. But the initial tyrants were people chosen by their fellows to get them out of a crisis. And the Roman system, too, by the way, had a method of dealing with crisis by the election of a special leader for limited amounts of time to solve crises. A dictator, in Latin, is initially part of the Constitution, not something separate from the Constitution, in the case of crisis. However, as the ideals of consensual rule of politeia developed in the Greek world, tyrant became a negative term. We read it in especially Plato, but also in Aristotle. It is there as the other side of freedom. We find the earliest critique in the great 5th century historian Herodotus, where there is a debate on constitutions, monarchy, oligarchy, democracy. One of the amazing things about the Greeks is they could debate anything. When I teach a course on the origins of democracy, we start off with the great debate on the constitutions in Herodotus. My question is, why is it that they can debate this and we can't? Right? We can't have a debate on this. It's already known what the best form of government is, and we can't discuss it. I must say, one year there was actually a very bright Iranian girl in the class who was persuaded by the arguments of monarchy and defended monarchy for the whole part of the class, much to the frustration of the other members of the class, because actually she had excellent arguments. She argued our system only worked when it was like a monarchy, on and on and on. It was quite a brilliant set of debates. Part of Herodotus' discussion of monarchy involves the critique of the bad monarch. And there are a set of symptoms that are true. Disregard for traditional rules, disregard for property, and interestingly enough, using violence against women. No Clinton comments, honestly. Let's try and keep this on the highest possible level. By the time that Aristotle, in the 5th book of the Politics, comes to his picture of the tyrant, it is a highly developed and sophisticated picture of what tends to exist in tyranny, the signs that you are losing free consensual rule was carefully worked out, and this certainly was part of the tradition that went down to the early modern period, picked up by Machiavelli, picked up by the great 17th century English liberal, Whigs, excuse me, and found in our Declaration of Independence. One of the signs of the misinterpretation of the Declaration that is clearest, perhaps, is the obsession with the introduction and the ignoring of the body of the Declaration. Equal appears once in the document. Tyrant, tyrannous, tyrannical, and despot appear a half dozen times. The document is about the rejection of tyranny. That's what the vocabulary tells us. And when Jefferson, at the end of his life, was asked by a young man named Henry Lee why it was the document was so unoriginal, because by the early 19th century people expected originality, Jefferson carefully explained it was never supposed to be original. It was to represent the consensus of his people as well as their tradition of their thinking based on what he called the works of common right, such as Aristotle, Cicero, Sidney, Harrington, and Locke. And if you look and see what Aristotle and Cicero, Sidney, Harrington, Locke have in common, because they have many things not in common, one is a critique of tyranny. It's precisely the ability to criticize a government as tyrannical that fills out the picture of consensual rule and citizenship in both Athens and in Rome, where the more common word was rakes or king. But still, the word tyrant was also found, and the concept is essential. The worst accusation thrown by an Athenian at his opponent was that he was aiming at tyranny. And indeed, Aristophanes makes fun of the fact that they're always saying that somebody's aiming at tyranny. Same thing is true in Rome, where rakes or king was the more common accusation. It was the most serious one. When the followers of Julius Caesar, who had followed him through battles that seemed hopeless and campaigns that seemed impossible to win, and yet he'd won them all, found out that his real intent was not the restoration of consensual rule, but making himself king, they killed him. That was the right thing to do in that context. But mentioning Julius Caesar brings up, just the very end of my talk, the final statement of what's the option to consensual rule. Consensual rule involves citizens who are active participants, who own property, who have all kinds of things that limit what a government can be. The fact is, those forms of government have existed only a few times in history, and they don't last forever. And what about the options? There's no question that we are facing a time in which we seem to be becoming an empire. It was predicted at near the beginning of this century by Spengler, who viewed it as an historical law. And there's no question that it is greeted by some people today with approbation. The Washington Post is running a series of articles on conservative intellectuals who favor empire. National Review Online this week had Mr. Derbyshire tell us, "Republic or empire? Empire, please. Empire, please." It may be that empire is our fate. It ought to be said that if it is our fate, is it possible to preserve the ideals won by the Greeks and the Romans and our founders and imperial system? If you look at the societies that followed Philip and Alexander's conquest, you'll no doubt get discouraged. If, on the other hand, you look at the Augustan model, it's not quite so discouraging. The difference between, well, there are many differences between Julius Caesar and Caesar Augustus, but one of the great differences is that Augustus never proclaimed himself king. That Augustus always insisted that he was restoring the Republic with modifications. That the empire that he set up was full of the ethical ideals and some of the political and economic constraints of the past. Even under empire, the traditions of freedom may be preserved. And in our own period today, I continue to believe with our founders that our model and our ideal remains Athenian democracy and the Roman Republic, those institutions where limitation on government and the active property owner, soldier, citizen is the model. If we have to face empire, we need to remember that there has been at least one empire in the history of the world where those ideals still survive to maintain public life, to maintain creativity, and to allow the growth eventually of that ideal out of the collapse of that empire. Having an expert on Ireland here, I think of one of my favorite lines of Yeats near the end of his life when he turned to his people and told them how to have prosperity and creativity in their future. "Cast your minds on other days, that we in future days may be still the indomitable Irishry. The traditions of freedom lie in the past, and knowledge of that past and teaching our children that past is the best way to ensure that there will be freedom for us in the short term, and then, if in God's will, not in the short term, then it will return again in the long term." Thank you for your kind attention.